and welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression. This is your host, Zilpha, and I've got John, my right-hand man.
Thank you.
And we have Lindsay back. Hey, Lindsay.
Hello. Happy to be here again.
Glad to have you. And we have Elisa. Hey, Elisa.
Hi. Always glad to be here, too.
We're glad you're here. And we're going to talk about something that we've not really talked a lot about on Mormon Expression before, and that is children. We've talked about how women are sort of expected to be responsible for the care of children. We haven't really talked about children themselves. So we're going to go into that, in how Mormonism defines children and treats children, and what Mormonism expects from children, and all of that fun
and how
stuff.
We're really good at having children.
Oh, yeah, we are, sort of.
Some of us,
some
I
of
guess.
Us. Let's start out at the very beginning.
In the pre-existence?
The pre-existence. So Mormons have this fairly unique concept of the pre-existence, which means that every person on the earth lived in spirit form before they were born. So what that basically does for us is tells us that children are not just children. They're like full-grown adult spirits in these little bodies. So parents don't create life. They just provide this glove of a body for this adult spirit.
So how again does that happen?
You know very well.
No, I'm not talking about sex. No, I mean, what's the transmission? What's going on?
Well, Brigham Young said in the Journal of Discourses, there are multitudes of pure and holy spirits waiting to take tabernacles. Now, what is our duty? So tabernacles would be your body. We use that word for body. I like that word for body. And he says, basically, our duty is to propagate to replenish the earth. So these spirits, once we have our babies, jump into our babies.
Jump into
or
the baby
born
body.
Into the baby. There's some discussion, a little debate about when the spirit actually enters the body.
Right.
But we believe that it's our job to provide mortal tabernacles or bodies for these spirit babies or children, people waiting to come down.
Yeah. In fact, Bruce R. McConkie, 1978 in the Liahona, said, "What is mortal birth? It is the process by which mature, aware, intelligent beings pass from pre-existence into a mortal sphere. It is the process by which we bring from pre-mortality to mortality the traits and talents acquired and developed in our long years of spirit existence. It is the process by which a mortal body is created to house an eternal spirit who is an offspring of the Father." So this doctrine also leads us to... It's one of the reasons why Mormons have so many children, really, because those spirits are waiting for a body. They want to come to Earth, and they want to be in a Mormon family. They would be disappointed if the Mormon family they were hoping to join decided not to have one more child, and they had to go live in Madagascar.
So zero population is the answer.
Let's go.
Friend.
Let's go back for a little minute.
Okay.
So in Mormon theology, everybody was born to Father in Heaven and Father and Heavenly Mothers, right? As a spirit, as a being, and before that, we were what they call intelligence, which no one knows what that means at all. But according to the Pro Great Price, right, we were all born at different times and we had agency, correct?
Right.
Because the host of heaven, who are these spirit children, chose not to come down to this plan. And others, according to the Pro Great Price, became the great and mighty ones. And others were fence sitters. And their position in life was sort of for ordained. Now, Mormons don't like to say that, but this is the Mormon equivalent of foreordination theology, right? Your position in this world can be explained by your position in the previous world. So that's how Moses got to be where Moses was, according to the Pearl Great Price.
And Abraham.
And that's how Christ got to be where he was, although he's a special case because he was the firstborn.
Well, my patriarchal blessing actually says that I sat in the grand councils of heaven with other great spirits and got to listen to Heavenly Father talking and heard the voice of Heavenly Mother, which is kind of cool. And I got to watch as prophets were chosen.
Wow. That's like the Mormon equivalent of being at Woodstock.
I know. So just know that you have a really special spirit in the room.
There's a common urban legend, right, of people in their patriarchal blessings who are mentally handicapped that says they escorted Satan out of the...
Is that an urban legend? Because...
Probably not. there's a lot of rogue patriarchs out there. Yeah. I
just know of a woman who swears... that is the purpose of her child. And I don't know if it's in the patriarchal blessing or not.
The problem is I probably have personally met, 70 or 80 escorts. there was a great big honor guard there, I guess. But for the uninitiated, the reason that they are mentally incapacitated on this world is so Satan, who's obviously ticked off at his being escorted out of the grand halls of the heavens, would go after this person with particular flair.
But he can't.
And I've also...
Because the devil's gay.
I've also heard, in pop culture, just the idea that they are so pure and so innocent that they will automatically get into heaven, And so it's almost it's a blessing for them to be handicapped and things like that because of their righteous choices before.
Mm-hmm. So they can be, foreordained with that, but gay people... are cursed, what they do.
They would be. You can explain away anything, right? With that doctrine, it's a very powerful doctrine because you can justify wealth, power, dominion, slavery.
Well, we did that for a long time. Black people were less valiant in the pre-existence, right. and I've heard someone in high standing in a ward before tell me once that the reason why the problems in Africa are so bad are because these people couldn't figure it out then and they can't figure it out now.
this is a sort of underground teaching, but it's still common. If you hung out with Mormons for any length of time, you'd hear somebody repeat it.
Right.
It's racist, but it's also culturalist and elitist. It's used to justify all sorts of things.
Right.
Well, and to tie it into kind of where Zilpha was headed with the discussion, the idea is that the choicest place to be born is to a Mormon family, of course. So the very elect go to Mormons and things like that. And I really like the end of the quote that you started to read by Brigham Young, where he says basically that to take a course that will not tend to drive those spirits into families of the wicked, meaning that we have to prepare these tabernacles and we can't drive them into the spirits of the families of the wicked where they will be trained in wickedness, debauchery, and every species of crime. It is the duty of every righteous man and woman to prepare tabernacles for all the spirits that they can, because it's a blessing to bring people to Mormonism. So.
Right. And so then we go into contraception and the pressure.
Wait, before we go there, I do want to point out that some of Mormonism's greatest doctrines quickly turn into some of its biggest liabilities. because with this doctrine, for Mormonism, this life is a test, which really relies on this pre-existent state that we come down here to be tested and proven to show that we will ultimately be worthy to the king or whatever. But if you allow for the fact that if Zilpha and I have fewer children, that somebody will go into a state of debauchery because of that. Debauchery?
I think you can say
tomato,
either
tomato. I like it either way. You sort of thwart the whole system. I mean, this has some real problems.
Wait. Are you saying that sometimes things don't match up to other things? I'm confused.
I'm just putting it out there.
Well, okay. And this was Brigham Young, and it's not necessarily current doctrine. There is no current doctrine.
I don't know of anybody who's repudiated that teaching. I mean, he stated it clearly, but it's in the Book of Mormon, American exceptionalism, the ideas of coming to the, only the blessed will be led here, only people who are selected.
I would love to see in the comments how many people have references in their patriarchal blessings to it, though. I bet it's pretty common. And it's kind of like a prosperity doctrine thing, like in the Book of Mormon, of, the righteous people are more successful. And so we see that now. But I remember, you know, if I had an opportunity over my friends, my mom would say, well, that's because you're doing what's right.
Wow.
So I for me and the childhood I grew up in, it's very lingering.
Well, the most common place I would see this teaching applied is in people who could play the piano. People would refer to pianists all the time as it being some talent because
that they had in the
because this doctrine is laid out in Mormon culture as your talents were given to you before and you need to develop them, and they oftentimes refer to it musical ability. Now, how the piano was there in the pre-existence, given its known evolution.
At least an organ or a harp.
Okay.
Well, you can use it to explain away a lot of things. I had a good friend whose name is Joe, and he grew up in a really dysfunctional family, and he turned out to be a really great person. And so, you know, if we're blessed and we're put into good families because we were so righteous, but he wasn't and he turned out to be good, you say, well, he was just a super strong spirit and his mission was to come to earth and overcome those things. Or, I mean, there's a explanation for everything, and that's why it's so appealing. And
well, it's just theologically a tangled mess, because like we say that we don't believe in predestination, but where's the line between predestination and foreordination, and where does agency come into play and all of that? And whenever you ask anybody about it, they just kind of try to give you their own version of it, but nobody really parses that out and spells out where is the line between foreordination and agency and things like that. So it's kind of a mess.
Can we go into contraception now? We do have a lot to cover.
There's a pun in that. About that. Continue.
So in the 1976 Handbook of Instructions, it said, it is contrary to the teachings of the church to artificially curtail or prevent the birth of children. And then it went on to say, the husband's consideration for his wife is his first duty, and self-control a dominant factor in all their relationships. So the idea was either have children or exercise self-control.
Pull out.
But now the Handbook of Instructions basically says we encourage husbands and wives to have children as they're able, but it is a decision between them and the Lord if they're going to use birth control methods or not.
So that's what the handbook states, but I'm also intrigued in how it operates in lived Mormon culture.
Yes.
You know, because there's oftentimes a disconnect between the handbook and what Mormons actually believe or think is right and things like that.
Well,
I think there always has been with this particular issue, at least.
Yeah.
Because you have Brigham Young was the first one that started like saying things about it. But it, like, the first presidency actually, I think, made the first statement with Joseph Fielding Smith, saying it's wrong, birth control is wrong, but that didn't prevent people from doing it. They were still doing it. And then I think Spencer W. Kimball was the last one who officially condemned birth control.
I've got Oaks and Packer and...
Well, what did they say?
I'm talking like prophetically, prophet speaking as prophet.
Okay, I'll grant you that.
Okay, because, I mean, I have a lot of quotes from apostles mentioning it. But I'm talking like official. And then we have things like Gordon B. Hinckley saying, well, that's up between you and the Lord and that kind of thing.
I think that was Hinckley was very soft on the birth control.
They won't say that's
issue.
Between you and the Lord without a but. People should have as many kids as they can handle.
Well, right.
That's true.
It's also couched in that rhetoric about like, oh, well, if you are able to have children, but you don't
delay
you're
it.
You're being selfish. Yeah. You're being self-centered. There's a lot of that negative stigma associated with delaying childbirth.
But how many people? Okay, this is a good example. So what I was going to say is they did a study at BYU. I think I want to say in the 60s or 70s to see how many people, what people thought of birth control, and you were still getting a lot of this rhetoric saying it's wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong, and a lot of people were still saying I use it, I use it, I use it, or I plan to use it. And it's the same thing now. Like, how many women do you know that have IUDs? But some Mormon women think it's totally controversial. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I know a lot of women that use birth control or get their tubes tied. That's
a little controversial.
That
is still controversial.
You know, I see this as one of those doctrines that, you know, I've researched out what the brethren have said on this. And it's one of those doctrines where I don't think the church ever changed. It's just there was such a mass rebellion against the doctrine. The same way with the Catholics. We're not particularly unique here. That the brethren have backed away from it.
They're not going to punish anybody for
but,
it.
But I mean, let's be frank. This ran into modern science, right? because we're much better at detecting pregnancy early. We're much better at caring for pregnant women. And if you've been in the Mormon circles for long enough, you will know some family that has 3 or 4 kids that are all like 9, 10, 11 months apart, and then they stop. The problem is with modern fertility, you could easily go Duggar and have 20 kids. And just people can't handle it. With modern science, you have to practice birth control today.
Yeah. Because the babies survive.
Right.
When they didn't before.
Right. And some of these guys who have been on their high horse about, birth control, you know, these old brethren, you know, they had 4 or 5 kids. Well, obviously there was something, you know, they weren't as blessed with fertility, and it's easy for them to say, oh, you should have as many kids as you can if you don't have 17 of them, you know.
Right.
Well, maybe they just exercised self-control.
They might have. It was just October of last year, 2011, Neil Anderson in the Quorum of the 12 had a whole talk about having children, basically. And one thing he said was, many voices in the world today marginalize the importance of having children or suggest delaying or limiting children in a family. And then he quoted, I think it was his daughter, as saying, motherhood is not a hobby. It is a calling. You do not collect children.
Because I do that for fun.
You do not collect children because you find them cuter than stamps. It is not something you do, something to do if you can squeeze the time in. It is what God gave you time for.
I'd really like to know what they think that women do all day, like, you know, collecting children stamps. They're just fun to dress up. They're not even a problem at all. Well, let's be clear. This comes from biblical roots, like, this is not just a Mormon thing. It's a right. Genesis thing, like multiply and replenish the earth.
Right.
But we have our own little spin on it, which is multiply, replenish the earth, and create as many Mormons as you can. Because we've got to spread the word of the gospel with
and
these kids.
We don't want to disappoint the spirits who are waiting for their earthly
Jimmy, don't
bodies.
Forget your promise. Sorry, I keep making Saturday's Warrior references.
Well, and if I could be a little bit Marxist here to kind of talk about how economics affects things, like in the when these kind of cultural ideas about children became codified in the Bible and things like that, we were in a primarily agrarian society where children were really important. Like, it was really useful to have a lot of children because then they could help along the farm and they would help, you know, make your family productive.
Which is why it was so popular with frontier doctrine as well.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why in Joseph Smith's time, you know, this doctrine would have been totally accepted and things like that. But now as we're getting into the 20th century and beyond, and our economic base is shifting away from children being an economic asset to an actual economic burden in some respects, we're seeing the shift in how we're talking about children, and it's becoming more about like the emotional value of children themselves. And like almost kind of like, I don't mean to get ahead of us, but like it's starting to get into that cult of children is where that idea starts to develop that children are these sacred, special things. And, you need to desire children because they're valuable in and of themselves and things
right.
like that.
That they are going to bring you the most happiness in life, and Mormons would say, and in the life to come.
Children, they're not just for factories anymore.
I think we're going to get into the cultural wars between women having children and not having children in the church. But I do want to emphasize one thing, not to whip out the predicate calculus here, but there is a problem that this doctrine causes a lot of distress to women and men. Because if you have a statement, X is true, X is true, X is true, X is true, and then you have X or Y, X or Y. When you look at those together, there's only one logical conclusion. It's X, right? So when you have birth control is evil, birth control is wicked, birth control is a tool of the devil, birth control is wrong, then you can have as many children as you want. There will be dishonest apologists who will say, see, the church says X or Y. But it's only when you ignore those previous statements. And their later statements saying have as many children as you're able to have, given that prophets of the Lord have said it's evil, and no one has ever said not X. No one has ever said no birth control is okay. If you read every statement, it's sort of like it's a necessary evil. They never say birth control is good, you know, get your rubbers on and have a good time. They never say that at all in any form. So there's a lot of people who really do distress about this. And it still causes a lot of emotional turmoil and pain. I think this bleeds over into the other things we do with children.
Can I share just a funny anecdote or scary anecdote? I know a woman that was in my former ward, and I swear I'm not making this up. She wanted another child and her husband didn't. And she went to the bishop about it, saying he wasn't doing his priesthood duty. And at the end of the day, she quit her birth control pills and secretly got pregnant.
Oh my gosh.
And she felt completely justified because it's the doctrine of the Lord.
Wow.
And well, it really caused some problems, but.
I can imagine. I have a really good friend who has MS. And so she has some struggles with MS and already has 3 children. And her husband said, I would be really disappointed if we didn't have another child. And she was like, well, I'm really tired and worn out. And I feel like I've just got way too much to handle. But they ended up getting pregnant again. So just lovely.
She did her duty.
She did.
It's hard given what we've talked about and what we're going to say, I don't want more children.
Because when I grew up, saying I want a smaller family was saying I am selfish.
In the course of us,
I don't want to have to worry about children. I don't want to care for children.
It's still considered selfish, I think. I can't remember. In one of these quotes I saw, it was saying, you know, women don't be selfish. And by putting off having children, and I think about like when you said. It's shifted to having children become a burden. If you say something like that, if you call children a burden in the church, that's naughty.
Women
don't acknowledge that their kids are hard and difficult, and sometimes being a mother is hard sometimes.
Right.
Well, and it's women can't even acknowledge that they may not like hanging out with kids all the time.
Right.
Now, I even hesitated saying that because it's so taboo in Mormon culture. Everybody loves their kids, right? And if you went outside Mormon culture, people can say, oh, you know, I hate Barney and, you know, I hate all that stuff. Is Barney dating myself? Is Barney the dinosaur still around?
But maybe Mickey Mouse
but
Clubhouse.
We have
or
had probably
like
in the course of working with ex-Mormons, probably 10 or 12 different women like break down and say, it's hard for me to admit that I don't like
being a mother.
Being
all
a mother.
The time.
And that is such a breakthrough when they hear that because it breaks through so many layers. That doesn't mean you don't love your kids or you don't want your kids or you don't want to be a good parent. But, I mean, let's face it. Parenting is not everybody's A-list activity.
Well, I remember our state president's wife telling a group of women in Relief Society, I hated those baby years when they were babies. And you could see some women in the audience, like,
the blood
take a
sigh
of
their face.
Well, yeah, some were, like, not shaking their heads like, oh, that is so wrong for you to say. How could you not love a baby? But some were like, really? I'm not crazy.
Well, because as a woman in the church, this is your one and only eternal destiny.
Right.
And if you don't like child rearing, what else you got?
We're
nothing.
Supposed to be innately, like,
nurturers.
Bred for this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, and to go back to your point about there being a social stigma against small families, long before I had my crisis of faith, I told my mom, I'm like, 2 is good for me. I'm going to stop at 2. I don't really want to have any more. And she mentioned it to my dad, and he got so upset. He was like, where is her faith? Where is her, you know? And I'm like, well, that's convenient coming from you. Notice that my mom doesn't make those statements.
And how many Mormons do you know, speaking of faith, attaching it to faith, who are not prepared to be parents? And the advice that they get from someone of authority is just have faith. It will all work out.
Right. You're going to have a few years of struggle, but it'll all be worth it. That's what Neil Anderson said in October. And he mentioned a family who started having kids while the husband was going to medical school, ended up with 3 kids before he finished, and they were glad they did, even though it was hard. And it's just, why do that to yourself?
Yeah, well, it's a good example of the church kind of speaking out of both sides of its mouth on that particular issue, because on the one hand, they say, oh, well, that's between you and the Lord. You know, you can decide how big your family is and when to have children. That's your decision. But then on the other side of their mouth, they're saying, but if you don't, you are, you know,
you're going to regret it.
Yeah.
And you don't have enough faith.
And you won't be blessed. And
this is the purpose of your existence here, is to bring mortal tabernacles.
Here and always.
But if you want to limit it and you want to decrease your purpose, fine. Good luck with that. But
And even for fathers, I mean, that's a big burden that they're supposed to bear.
Should we even talk about what it's like if you can't have children?
Oh,
or,
good Lord.
Or worse, choose not to have children?
That's almost unheard of.
No one can. That's just they can't
fill in the blank.
They can't process that, right? It can't be done.
I actually don't know of anyone.
I don't.
I do, and I can't process it.
Sinners.
I can't process how you can be faithful LDS and say we don't want to have children. I have to admit I've had the same conversation. Because it's sort of rejecting
your whole identity in the eternities.
To me, it's a very strange position given their theological belief.
Well, here's what I think. I feel like there's a caste system around marriage and children in the church. I feel like the upper class are the married with children. The middle class is the married without children, and the lower class are the singles, essentially. Then, of course, you have the outcasts, which are the divorcees and the single mothers, especially if they had it out of wedlock or things like that. But it's very clear that there is that. I mean, I even have like single friends who are like, I can't hang out with you anymore because you got married. And that means we can't hang out anymore. Like, it's like it is a caste thing.
It literally is. Well, maybe not literally, but close to. Because the callings that you get are based on, you know, when Zilpha and I, we went 6 years before we had our children. And every ward you move into, there's quickly callings that within a heartbeat, they'll put you in. And they'll patronizingly say, well, we want you to be the parents of the children of the ward. And they'll put you in the nursery.
Mothers in Zion.
Right. And so. Right.
If you don't have your own children, here, take ours.
Here's
them.
A fun fact. The first 65 years of primary was ran by single women or childless women, I should
really?
Say.
Really?
That's interesting.
Wow. Well, that followed the educational pattern of the 19th century, right?
Yeah, it did. It literally did. You had a lot of the school marm mentality of the single unwed school mom marm. But we see that now. I mean, and they were told in primary, I'm trying to think of the exact document, but that they were mothers in Zion, and that's how they fulfilled their purpose, was instructing other people's kids.
Right. You sort of practice with other people's kids, and eventually, maybe after this life, you'll have a chance to have your own children. They always sort of put in that caveat to make people feel better because they feel bad. They feel really bad.
We're all about proxy.
If they're putting the singles or the married without children into those callings to make them enjoy being around children, I think that's working against them, personally. Primary is rough.
Well, can we talk about something? Maybe this is not the good time to bring it up, but I was thinking about the status of children in the church. We're talking about a caste system and the status.
Yeah.
Children literally are a status symbol. And
yeah,
I was reading a very interesting article by Levina Fielding Anderson, one of the scary feminists of the 90s. She was talking about her experience in primary, and she was saying, you know, in a hierarchy, it's a status system in a hierarchy. And if the leaders are at the top, sometimes we like to think the women are at the bottom, but the women are not at the bottom. The bottom rung is children.
Yes.
And they are the lowest of the hierarchy. And that's the nature of the beast. It's not intentional, but you have women or children that have no status and no voice in the church, which is kind of a mixed message because we get this cult of childhood or children that we talk about. And that's what made me look into this, because with women in the church, we're told how great we are constantly. And that's how we know how great we aren't, because we have to be constantly told that we're great. So when I started reading all of these quote after quote after quote of how great children are, it made me suspicious. And I looked into this. And if you look at primary callings, if children are the lowest status, primary callings are the lowest status. Mm-hmm. Why do you think everybody hates nursery and primary?
And why they have to keep saying, children are wonderful. Exactly. We love our children. They're close to God. Let's see, a quote from Hinckley. It was at a fireside in 1994. Children are the epitome of innocence. They are the epitome of purity. They are the essence of love. They are the essence of hope and gladness in this difficult and troubled world.
Yeah. And for the record, I don't think any of us here believes that LDS people for a minute do not love their kids.
No, and
or the leaders
fact,
don't.
It's almost, I understand what you're saying about the class position of children, but that's sort of how they are in the world.
Well, I think it's I was thinking about that too, because I was like, people are going to think I'm grasping at straws here. But then I was looking at it. Okay. So in our doctrine, children are very important, but institutionally, we totally devalue them. So just stay with me for a minute.
But hold on. We spend a lot of money on them. Way more money on children than we do on adults.
Well, I think to throw another, I think they're fetishized in yes. in the classic yes. sense. The same way, if you think about like a virgin in the Mayan culture about to be thrown into a volcano right. was, they would spend a lot of money on her, and they would have her at the central of the ordinance.
And they would say she was great.
She was very important, but she was going in the lava. You know what
but,
I'm saying?
I mean, there's a reason for it. When I say that children are status, I mean they literally are. They hold a status. As for their potentiality, like their potential tithe payers, there's this great talk by Elder Ballard in 1991, where he talks about children are future leaders. He says, you know, some people say boys will be boys, but no, boys will be men. And you are raising the future children, but we don't practice what we preach institutionally. And here's just an example. So we've got the 3-hour block, right? That whole structure was designed around the needs of the parents, not the children. You know,
I
think about it.
I completely agree with that. I mean, that was
totally not.
Kids are not that.
Yeah, not only that. I mean, to emphasize that, if you live in a Mormon populated place where you're not the only ward in the building, like in Utah and Idaho and stuff, they have wards that go from 11 to 2. No person who is a child caregiver would ever do such a crazy
lunchtime
thing.
Lunchtime and nap time.
Yeah, because you're leaving your house at 10:30, right? You're not getting home till 2:30, and there's no food breaks, right?
Mm-hmm. So they do that, and then you think about the primary structure. First of all, everyone hates being in primary. Okay, not everybody. And I'm not trying to say we don't have good leaders in primary, because we do, and I've seen it. But we have a big problem with teachers showing up in primary. This goes across the board. People planning crappy lessons. And while that happens in church in general, I believe it's totally less tolerated in, say, priesthood for teachers to act that way than it is in primary. You know, if children are so important and they're the future, why are we not investing more things around their needs? We're not.
Lindsay, I probably would have argued with you when I was a member of the church, but when we first left the church, you know, we said before we hung out with the Unitarian Church for a while, and we volunteered in the youth program, and I taught for a lot of years 9-year-olds voluntarily. I can tell you the programs are night and day from what you're saying. In the Mormon church, it's a skeletal program. There's no resources developed. You go in this room that looks literally like a prison cell. It's cinder block. It's white. There's no resources. There's
That's
no,
true.
There's no crayons. There's no paper. Mm-hmm. And you sort of have to haul that stuff in, and you go to other church programs and they'll have cabinets full of supplies.
And the members
and
will decorate the rooms, and they'll paint the rooms. They'll be comfortable and cozy for children.
There's curriculum. Mm-hmm. There's training. There's people who want to
that
be there
who are
interested in teaching children the way children
there's
learn.
Absolutely curricula
offensive.
And training in the Mormon
well,
primary.
There is, but this is something Levina said, because and I would have argued with myself about women's status in the church a few years ago, but she said if women are not at the top of the hierarchy either, the primary consists of women representing children, which is a recipe for institutional forgetfulness. I mean, you have this thing. I was talking to Kaimi, who we did the podcast with before, and he said, you know, there's something really weird about a dynamic of women who have no power over men except when they're their teachers in primary, right? So that's an opportunity for women to teach boys, you know, the things that they want in their own husbands, kind of,
yeah.
Which seems natural, but in a way, it's kind of strange when you think about that too. I mean, we can teach them what we want as a spouse, you know, be respectful and these masculine roles of don't look at porn, but be a good leader. And so really, women teaching children when both of them are in a hierarchy, it's just kind of a really interesting system.
I do have to point out that there is this last FU given to the women in the primary. this is completely by design, which is the last year that the children are in there, the boys all leave the primary because they now have priesthood. And they show their dominance over the women by going out. The girls who turn 12 do not do the same thing, right?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, they do.
Do they leave and they come back in?
They don't come back in. The girls
come back in to primary eventually. The men do not. Once you turn 12, you don't get called back into it.
You're saying
as a teacher, you do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but that happens right there in there that those boys in the primary become a higher status than the primary leaders.
Yep.
From the primary. They skip all the way over to the top of the women.
Yeah. Yikes. Well, that reminds me of like something I read. I think it was on the Exponent blog, an overheard conversation where there was this, young woman leader who was arguing with a 12-year-old boy about something. Like she wanted him to get in the car to go to the activity or something like that. And at one point he says, "Well, I have the priesthood and you don't." And all the boys in the room cheered and they were like, "You won." Pwned, you know.
There was just a joke about that at conference, I guess, about a man driving in the car.
Oh, yes.
And he said, "Well, I have the priesthood," to his wife. And he was like, "Brethren, don't ever say that."
Right. Yes.
But we don't do that. Well, I just want to say one more thing about primary. I was thinking about this. So I teach preschool. I'm around kids a lot and child development interests me. But we have this really big attitude of reverence in church. And I was actually talking to my mom about raising the kids in the church or not. And she said, "But Lindsay, you can teach them good things without the church, but they're going to miss things like how to be reverent. That's really important." And Levina Fielding Anderson was saying, reverence is teaching your children to be docile and to sit still. That's not...
And to not think about things.
Exactly. Yeah, she said that's not a religious thing or a human value. That's a hierarchical value.
This was a concern for us because our children were very wiggly.
Oh, so wiggly.
I think I even have a conversation with my mother that we were concerned that not making them sit through church would not teach them reverence. What I found was reverence was only there to serve the church. Having a rambunctious 4-year-old running around smelling flowers is not a problem unless you're trying to sit through sacrament meeting. And the rest of the world is smart enough to know we don't try to make kids sit through an adult service for an hour and 10 minutes. So it's sort of a moot point.
Right.
You know, so it's a self-serving value that really doesn't have any application outside of the institution.
Well, and you look at Jesus who his goal was not sit and be quiet and listen to me. It was follow me. Let's get stuff done. Let's go serve. Right. But kids in primary, the messages they're getting are Jesus loves me when I'm quiet. Mm-hmm. You know, you were going to say something sitting still is being reverent, and reverence is such an important value. And I think that, Levina's right. Reverence is a hierarchical value. It's not a spiritual or religious value.
Well, and what you were saying earlier about the church sort of using, didn't someone say something about the church using children for their own means and like the boys will become men? In 1999, Patricia Penninger, the primary president at the time, said, "Primary is a model of conversion and retention. We help prepare children for baptism. We attend their baptisms and offer support and encouragement. Then we continue to love and involve the children in meaningful ways as we help them learn how to keep their baptismal covenants. Children are priceless converts."
Well, one of the things that is kind of going from Salt Lake, if I understand correctly, a relative of mine who serves in the High Council say that they've been getting some messages from Salt Lake that they need to preach to the wards about the importance of having children get baptized at 8, because they found that if children get baptized at 8, they're more likely to remain in the church, ergo pay tithing and things like that. So there's been kind of a recent emphasis on, you know, mm-hmm. getting those children at age 8.
Yeah. Can I tell you, I have a great quote for that. This is Arthur Schopenhauer, the 19th century philosopher. And he said, "If in early childhood certain fundamental views and doctrines are paraded with unusual solemnity and an air of the greatest earnestness never before visible in anything else, if at the same time the possibility of a doubt about them is to be completely passed over or touched upon, only to indicate that doubt is the first step to eternal perdition, the resulting impression will be so deep that, as a rule, in almost every case, doubt about them will be almost as impossible as doubt about one's own existence." So he's basically saying if you can get it in deep and not give them any room for doubt, you say, this is a fact. There's no other information. it's going to become so much ingrained as their identity, as their own existence, which I think is why it's so hard for people to leave the church.
Oh, yes. Yeah. They have to cut that stuff out. And it's a very painful process because it, like you're saying, these beliefs, which are sort of sometimes just weird beliefs about metaphysics that really don't have any bearing on anything, are just grown through their organs. It's not, you can't just discard that stuff.
Well, I talked to a sociologist last week, and she was telling me that your culture actually imprints itself on your brain, like it rewires your brain, mm-hmm. and the connections that it makes and things like that. So, you know, by the time you've reached an adult, that's, you know,
part
so
of well, you. And there's this child development study, and I'm sorry for the animals lovers out there because it's kind of cruel, but it's called the kitten carousel study, and it's pretty popular. And basically, what they would do is neurologists would take some kittens on a carousel that would be like spinning around and let them roam around freely, right? So they're walking around on this spinning thing, and other kittens they would take and strap to the table and tie them around, but they were spinning as well. And they did this for long periods of time, and then they would see how the kittens responded, how their brains worked. And what they found was that the kittens that had more freedom in their movement, in their environment, were able to make a wider variety of choices than those that were strapped to the carousel. Does that make sense? So,
yeah, sort of like Plato's cave.
Yeah, exactly. So if your environment is so controlled and your choices are so controlled at a young age, you're going to make similar decisions to others like you. And I think that that's kind of what we want, isn't it, in the church? We want to control the environment so they make those choices that we want them to take.
Right. Well,
does that make any sense? Am I making
sense?
Yeah,
it makes sense. Yeah. And when Jesus says, be ye as a child, I mean, that was 2,000 years ago. I don't know what he meant. I know how it's employed in the church, which means do not question what we're saying. And when we talk about reverence, that sort of docile, you're going to sit and listen and we're going to sit and give you instruction, is what we want. We don't want people to critically go and examine things then and say, yes, I agree with you. I've been through this. I've searched out and I agree with you. We don't want that. We just want immediate amen.
Well, and like the cats, we don't have freedom to move intellectually, and literally children don't have freedom to move. You know what I mean?
During
we don't
church,
have move
right.
in our movement in our own environment.
Well, to piggyback on what you were saying, John, I was always confused about the rhetoric about becoming like a child and things like that, because I was like, that doesn't seem very like a very desirable state, to be helpless, to be dependent on other people, to be ignorant.
Gullible.
Gullible, like trusting of everything and things like that. But when you really think about it, that is kind of, you know, how the church does sort of think about the ideal person and individual being, like trusting the church, being dependent on them,
right,
and things like that.
And who are our parents in this scenario? If we're children in the church, who are the parents?
The church.
Right. I don't see it being Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother. Where are you?
Right. And this is, you know, Zilph and I were talking about this before. I mentioned this before. But what the church wants to do is keep everybody in a child status, mm-hmm. Where they're not. And if you think about the way you learn in elementary school versus the way you learn in the university, what model does the church use? It's forever teaching the same basic lessons over and over and over again with no application. It doesn't want you free thinking. What it wants you is in its forever handicapped adolescent state of full dependence. They're sort of like drug pushers, right? They want to keep you forever dependent on the drug that they're giving
you. Well, and look at what Zilph was just saying, all these quotes about children and how great they are. I mean, who wouldn't want that? Children are happy and they're innocent and they're perfect and they're beautiful and they have this wisdom that's divine. You know, who wouldn't want that? I want that.
Let's talk, because this is it kind of in juxtaposition to what we were saying 10 or 15 minutes ago. Let's talk about the fetishization of children again.
All
where
right.
Where the children are.
You never read the notes.
I haven't read your notes.
You were supposed to.
Oh, well, I don't want to prejudice my mind.
So the fetishization of children.
Does it really say that in your notes? I thought I just made that word up.
No, we had the cult of
the child.
Oh, okay. Could be talking about something completely different.
Oh.
Yeah, but it's the same concept. And it is that children are, like we said, sort of pure before God. And Mormons actually believe that there's a thinner veil between children heaven, basically, that they have this special spiritual awareness and knowledge that adults no longer can access.
But we were talking about this before. That's how I knew it was in your notes. As I was thinking about it, I don't think this applies to all children. I think this applies to very young children, especially pre-verbal children. Yeah. There's this sort of belief among, I've heard it expressed a lot of times that, well, the children are looking at angels. You've probably heard that
infants,
one.
Infants. They look around and they're like,
or there's also this folk belief that before kids are verbal, they can remember before the veil.
And that's mm-hmm. why they I've can't speak, because if they could speak, then they would say things that would, you know,
jeopardize our agency.
Yeah, would jeopardize our ability to have faith, because then we'd know.
If they're so smart, I don't know why they don't stop pooping their pants, but I don't know where
it
this...
It comes with the angels. I don't know.
But they do need constant teaching and constant reminders about the gospel and how to be good, and its parents, the parents' duty, there's that duty word again, to provide that. And parents are supposed to do daily prayers, daily scripture reading. They're supposed to do a weekly family home evening night, which is basically another church lesson at home. Parents are supposed to bear their testimonies to their children. Let's see. The proclamation on the family says, parents have a sacred duty to rear their children in love and righteousness, to provide for their physical and spiritual needs, and to teach them to love and serve one another, observe the commandments of God, and be law-abiding citizens wherever they live.
Well, going along with the kind of cult of children that we've talked about comes with fetishization of parenthood and the role that parenthood plays in the world. Let me read a quote from Hinckley. He says, "It's so obvious that the great good and the terrible evil in the world today are the sweet and bitter fruits of the rearing of yesterday's children. As we train a new generation, so will the world be in a few years. If you're worried about the future, then look to the upbringing of your children," and things like that. So just kind of this idea that all of this heavy, heavy responsibility for the future of the world rests on the daily decisions being made by parents.
Right.
Well, and I think, like, if you go to Desert Book and you Google parenting, there's, like, hundreds and hundreds of hits on parenting books. And I know that there are several couples, I'm trying to think, I think I wrote it down somewhere, people that have made, like, their living being speakers on parenting. I mean, because parenting is so important, like you talked about, and because the future is responsible, we worry about it so much.
And it becomes a status symbol, how your children look, how your children behave, how well your children have memorized the primary songs, how well they memorize scriptures.
Absolutely. And it
how well
continues.
They pray, how well they do their testimonies.
It continues into adulthood, too.
Yes,
you know,
it
like
does.
I was talking to somebody today about how she was going through a crisis of faith and how her parents were so upset about it because now they can't say they have 100%, you know, no empty seats in the celestial kingdom anymore. So it's like they're blaming her for, you know, bringing their status in the church down a notch and things like that.
Yep.
So what it is that the parents' identity is centered in the children, you know, and I think that's a very problematic relationship.
Well, I would even say not a parent so much as a mother, and not that men do not have a status because they do, but I think men's status linked to children is for a different reason. And it has to do with priesthood responsibility. And I think it's kind of this eternal idea of procreation and masculinity. But women, I mean, since that is our primary role, basically our only role is to parent. If you do it wrong, you failed your life purpose.
Yeah, you're basically no good as a woman.
And if you're a man and you mess up, you could still be a good bishop, you know?
Right, yeah. We all know church leaders who have awful kids, right? But you know, not to always circle back to women as second-class citizens, but you look at what happens. You know, we've talked about women in charge of the nursery and in charge of all those sort of functions. But what happens, the men will step in and they'll bless the baby up in front of everybody.
Oh,
and then they'll hand the baby back to the mother.
Right.
I mean, it's almost a ceremonious thing where the mother will hand the baby to the father. He'll go do the show and then he'll hand it back to the mother. And then when the child is eight, the father will again get up and baptize and ordain while the woman has to sit and look on.
But
and
then we got to do the special part. We got to give birth to it.
even
which is so fun and wonderful.
When the father gets to deliver blessings, you know.
Wait, even yeah, when like there's female things, like the young women's medallion. Who gives the woman the young woman's medallion? The bishop does.
Mm-hmm. What role does a woman have in any of these rites of passage?
She gets to sit
children?
Down and smile.
Yep. Or maybe prepare a really cute talk about the testimony glove.
But at least, she can show off.
Right, because the success of the child reflects on the status of the mother.
Right. And since
that's all we've got.
Since you brought up baptism, I think we should just mention real quick, Mormons do have a slightly different view on baptism of children also. And it's sort of a big deal that to Mormons.
It's a big deal to Mormons.
That they don't baptize their infants. Like Catholics do. You know, it's always the Catholics dripping water on infants' head, and oh, isn't that ridiculous? And then we go dunk our 8-year-olds into baptism thinking, oh, well, they know. They have this ability to choose. They have this ability to know right from wrong by age 8.
And have you all heard that folk science, like, given in Sunday school before, where they're like, some scientists did the study and found that the brain... something happens when they turn 8 in the human brain, and suddenly it's able to do all these crazy cognitive things that it wasn't able to do before.
Yeah, like if a 7-year-old boy is touching his penis at 7, it's totally innocent, but when he does it at 8, naughty, naughty, he better repent.
Right. At that point, he would have to repent.
Well, and I was looking up actually the doctrinal basis for that the other day, because I think someone on Facebook had asked that. And really, there is none, but I do know that in Joseph Smith's time, there was... I hope I'm saying this right. The doctrine of an annihilism, is that right? Where if you didn't baptize your child as an infant, then they were lost to you forever, right? And so this was on people's mind. And Joseph had 6 children that died as infants.
Hold on.
Oh, you're fine.
Quinn Larson, we're recording. Go open it out of the room.
Children.
Yeah. Children. Gosh.
No, so children, where was I? Joseph had 6 kids that had died. This was on Emma's mind. People around him had children that died. And if your baby died and wasn't baptized, that was a big deal. And so that was in Joseph's mind. I think when the Book of Mormon we had Moroni 8, which basically said that children are saved and pure. And that later led to the Doctrine and Covenants, where I think it, specifically says, yeah. Where it says that 8 years old is the magic number.
And then we have the King Follett, which has children on thrones.
We have a few other sermons like that, that were in relation to people dying.
Right.
And there are hymns, apparently in the early hymn books, there are hymns that dealt with a lot of grieving and death that were really sad that we don't have today, because that's a very frontier idea of, it was, you know, moving in separation and losing someone and never seeing them again.
Well, I've looked at my old genealogical records, and I don't know the statistics, but, you know, you see all these, even 60, 70 years ago, you see they had 8 kids and 3 of them died before they turned 8.
Right.
And you know, I know that before the turn of the 20th century, 1 in 10 women died in childbirth, you know, so that grieving of losing children, of losing mothers would have been so much more ever present than it is with us.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the doctrines we have, for good or ill, carry over from a frontier idea.
Right.
And this is definitely one of them. Now, we get kind of tricky because then we get into the idea of agency and children being able to make choices. And like you said, this folk doctrine, which totally goes against neuroscience, saying that, you know, an 8-year-old is all of a sudden so wise.
Right. It's not until... Well, there are some things that happen between the ages about 6 and 9. That do give children more self-control.
Well, they develop impulse control.
Right. But, I mean, it's sort of obvious. I mean, if you watch children, you can say, yeah, an 8-year-old, they have more control definitely than a 5-year-old does. So
but
I'm sure Joseph
has less control than a 6-year-old. I mean, this is child development.
Right.
When we're talking about agency, which is supposed to be the cornerstone of our religion, right? It's kind of a strange doctrine. And I have to point this out too, because this is more folk. And maybe you guys can correct me on this, but oftentimes when I go to baptisms, I hear this, you'll have someone get up, a mother or grandmother, give this talk to the child, and they will say to the child, when you're baptized, all your sins will be washed away. You go in the water and you'll come out pure and clean. And I think, well, wait a minute. If you're 8 and you're innocent, what sins do you have, right? You don't have anything. So what's being washed away?
Well, usually they get baptized like maybe a few days after they turn 8. So they have a couple days of sins to get washed away.
There's a theological conundrum that's probably beyond the focus of this podcast about whether or not kids can sin or they just automatically get a free pass for their sin.
Well, but I wonder if you look at paintings from, 19th century, children are always painted as little adults. They look like tiny adults, essentially. And so perhaps in Joseph Smith's day, like an 8-year-old was perceived as a little adult, you know, before they had the cognitive neuroscience to back up those kind of claims. So maybe that's where some of the 8 stuff comes from.
Yeah, I don't know. Why. Well, it seems sort of random. Why 8?
I was just going to point out that when in the early church, adults were baptized. Like it was an adult thing.
Yes.
And they didn't really worry about kids. I mean, so much. They worried that their souls would be saved. But under the Book of Mormon, children were innocent. And so.
Right, it didn't say age 8 in the Book of Mormon.
As far as I know, there's no reason. I tried to research why 8, you know, behind the revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants.
My best guess, and I want to confirm what you're saying, because you read 19th century history in Utah, and you'll have very faithful members of the church who would oftentimes let their kids go to 15 or 16, or, you know, they wouldn't, it wasn't as imperative to get them baptized at 8. But usually during in the agrarian era, around 7 or 8 is when the kids would start going and working in the fields. So that was sort of the age when you graduated from being a child under the foot of mother to actually sort of earning your keep. So my best guess, which is pure speculation, is that's why it was there. You know, cause we have the Constitution where clearly, you know, there was an idea of adulthood being around 18 or 21. So I don't think they fully said, oh, 8, this is a cognitive equal here.
Or let me give you another suggestion. God knows that there's something special about 8 that we don't know. So,
well, I actually don't mind that. I think it's not preferable. If I was giving advice to religion, I'd say wait till they're adult. But it's just another form of infant baptism. Sort of annoys me is that on the one hand, they'll criticize infant baptism and say we baptize at 8. 8 is infant baptism.
You know what, John? I would say that baptizing 8-year-olds is a lot more manipulative than baptizing an infant. An infant doesn't know. It doesn't matter. But an 8-year-old, you can really manipulate that little kid.
It wouldn't be so bad if we didn't attach the agency with it.
And you can also, you also hear talks every single time a kid's getting baptized. We are so proud of you for making this wise and righteous decision.
As though we're there.
Raise your hand if you've got the Facebook status. At least I have. I'm so proud that Colin chose to be baptized.
Right. As if they really had a choice.
Right. And for a lot of ex-Mormons, they choose not to go to baptisms of their friends and families. And it is a big effing deal for Mormons.
Yeah.
That's oftentimes one of the very first big rifts is either to not baptize their kids.
But why would an ex-Mormon not go to a baptism of their niece or nephew?
Sometimes on moral objection.
And is there also...
It's purely a religious ceremony. And the talks are fairly manipulative. They're usually about Holy Ghost and baptism.
Okay.
And a complete misunderstanding of the doctrine, too.
I have a personal objection to baptizing 8-year-olds. But you, if you go to a baptism, it is like glaringly clear that you're not getting up with the other brothers to do the confirmation.
What she's talking about is as a man, if your family's being baptized, you will be expected to participate in the confirmation, at least.
Right.
Where you'll be expected to stand in the circle. So if you go, you can't just go and hide in the back.
You have to sit with the women.
Everyone looks and notices who doesn't come.
And there's shame attached to that.
Definitely.
It's oftentimes, that's why it's a dilemma for ex-Mormons or people who are struggling with their testimony. And I went through something similar to this. I happened to be sick at the time, but it was a big dilemma because I was still struggling. I was still going to church. I didn't feel like I wanted to mock the ceremony by participating in it when I didn't believe it.
And also have you mocked by not getting up and
doing it. Because I wasn't ready to make that declaration because I wasn't there myself yet. So, but you can see why these are in place. These are social controls to keep pulling people
back in. But then again, when I think about these things, I think most of the time, it's unintentional. Like, we talk about these conspiracies of indoctrination, and I see that as a byproduct of hierarchy. It's the structure that's the problem. And I don't have any answers how to get away from that or how to have an institution without that. But, I mean, I don't think that, you know, people are consciously thinking, how do I trick my child into baptism? It's not
that.
Oh, Lizzie, we see it as a real...
I agree 100%. That these things evolve in institutions just like evolutions. The blind watchmaker, they make for more effective institutions. I don't think there's anybody pulling the strings and designing these things.
I just wanted to make that clear.
Yeah,
that
I think it's a good point.
There's not some maniacal man upstairs. And there could be. I don't know. I've never been upstairs before. But
the point is that it functions that way.
It totally functions that way.
And these things creep into all institutions unless the institution is very cognizant of it and puts in structures to keep from doing that. I mean, let's compare it to like the United States government. When the founders, they specifically did divisions of powers and balance and checks and things like that to keep these sort of institutional, you know, creeping vines from taking over. The problem that the church has, it has no feedback loop. It has nothing to prevent these things.
So, and we are raised in the system. I mean, I never thought about children being devalued in the system or women being devalued in the system because I was part of the system.
Right.
You know, and so we grow up. Or, well, I guess I would say you, as John, would grow up and go into the church and go into leadership and perpetuate these same ideas on everybody else.
Because that's just what you know.
That's the institution, yeah.
So let's end with the question, is Mormonism a good place to raise children?
Yeah, this is important for two reasons, and I just want to say this up front. First of all, because I've probably made more enemies on this on this statement than anything. And secondly, because this is a binding principle that keeps a lot of people in the church who don't believe. If you took the average ward and got people aside and started saying, do you believe this? I would guess anywhere from 5 to 20, 25% really don't buy the lion's share or even foundational pieces of the story.
You mean of Mormonism itself?
Of Mormonism. They'll reject big key elements of Mormonism. I mean, I'm saying that one in five.
Everyone's a cafeteria Mormon.
Most people are cafeteria Mormons. And probably the other group, they just don't think about it. Not that they're dumb. They just think about other things. It's just not a concern for them.
Or they choose not to think about it.
So, but
they buy John McNaughton paintings.
Oh, good Lord.
I didn't say that. I was joking.
But this issue of children, and because of everything we've talked about, really makes the leaving the church dilemma for people who have kids. It is an agonizing decision on both fronts, for people who stay in, for people who leave, all that kind of stuff. There's no one who gets out.
Okay, so usually the last thing to go is the thought of raising children in the church.
So what are the positives that you can see
I'm going to give you a kind of a wishy-washy answer. I think it depends on your view about children and people in general. I think Mormonism is certainly capable of making useful worker bees, you know, who can take orders from their employers, who can be good neighbors, who can be generally productive members of the community. Mormonism is capable of doing that. But I'm not so sure that Mormonism fosters a good environment for making thoughtful people who are capable of independent thought and self-criticism, of having empathy and concern for people who are different from them, or for people who can adapt to changing circumstances, who are flexible and
things like
that.
Can I give you an example of that?
That was very well said.
Bearing testimonies. It was very well said, and it got my brain going on a bunch of different things, because agency is so important, right? We say it's so important, but it's really not. And when we think about bearing testimonies, there's always this criticism of don't let your kids bear testimonies. And I was looking up the doctrine in 1917, and they were saying, you know, kids should tell you what they know. That's their testimony. And I was thinking, you know, if a kid got up today during sacrament meeting and told you what he knew, it would probably be like, I know my teacher is nice. You know, I know flowers are pretty. That's not what we want to hear. We are bugged enough that they get up at all, some of us. And I thought that's because we really don't want to foster an idea of what we know in a testimony. A testimony is supposed to be what we know. But with kids, they're not allowed to say what they really know. They say they stick to a script that sounds good, and we carry that with us as adults.
What is the script?
Of
I love I to bear my church. Testimony. Mm-hmm. I know this church is true. Where's I love my mommy and yeah. daddy, and I know the prophet, president, whoever it is, Monson.
So they don't want independent thought, like you were just saying. That's not what they want. They want people to follow. And I heard someone say, I think it was on Mormon Stories podcast, that he wanted to raise his kids by giving them a Liahona, not an iron rod.
Well, I'm taking a parenting class right now taught by a child therapist, and one of the kind of mantras that she has is beware of what works, because you might get short-term compliance, but you're not going to get you're not going to make long-term adults who are capable of making decisions for themselves, because in Mormon society, where the locus of morality is centered within the church or the parents, in that case, it's like the church's responsibility to dictate what is moral and what is not. You look to the church to know what is right and what is wrong, and to guide your behavior and things like that. Well, what happens when children leave that, you know, when they leave Mormonism or just leave their parents, you know, they go off to college. If they've been told all their lives, this is how you have to behave, then it was the parent who was the one who was responsible for determining what morality was, as opposed to the child. So the child, once they're out of that, out from underneath that roof, can no longer really distinguish what is, you know, what is morality for themselves.
They don't just teach us what morality is. They teach us what success is and what happiness is.
But the church doesn't want them. That goes back to my point before. The church wants them constantly dependent on the church.
Right.
So, you know, I've heard it said explicitly as a missionary, and I know others have heard it said, your parents hand you off to the mission president, and the mission president says, go find a companion as quickly as you can. Go get married as quickly as you can, because you're not to be trusted alone, and you're dependent upon the church. So I think you're exactly right. But the church wants it that way. They want the right. people to not have
so
that.
So do parents, though. I mean, as a parent, right now I'm a parent. The idea of my kids always making the choice that I want them to make is awesome to me. Like, that sounds really great.
I want you to brush your hair. I don't yeah. care if you don't care about your hair.
If they took on all my opinions, they would be awesome, right? In my mind.
Right.
But that's not what's going to happen. Kids grow up and break their parents' hearts. It doesn't matter if you're active Mormon or you're not. It well, just comes with the territory.
Yeah.
I do think there are some positives, though.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, but seriously, kids who grew up in Mormonism have this sense of specialness that can bleed over into a sort of a good self-esteem and confidence. And they have a sense of community that also fosters a sense of confidence and sort of feeling safe in that environment. And they have opportunities for service that, you know, they might not have otherwise. And they have public speaking opportunities.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the things that I've learned through church activities. I'm really good at organizing events and I guess even public speaking. And I learned that through church. And that's not to say you can't learn those through other avenues, but that right. was the avenue that I learned it
or
from.
Other churches. So, and the negatives that
well,
I
want to agree with your positive before you move on to negatives, because I do think the church has a well thought out program. I mean, we're sort of pointing out all the real difficulties with it. The real problem with the church has in this and other avenues is it's always one size fits all. Mm-hmm. There are kids who will thrive under that particular arrangement. We all can probably think back to high school to some kid who is really lost and joined the Marine Corps and bam, that put him right in order.
Right.
For most of us, with our personalities, that wouldn't be an environment we would thrive in. There are other environments. So I think the rigid sort of upbringing that the church gives some kids are going to thrive under that. It's going to
the
make them much better.
The useful worker bees, yes.
Yeah, and also I have to point out in Utah especially, or in communities where Mormonism is more popular, it does give your children an identity and a group of friends automatically.
Which is very important.
Yes, and it gives people that other people that speak their same faith language and their same kind of dialect, really. And that was very beneficial to me. I always found a great core from my ward.
Mm-hmm. When the transformational effect of people who buy into Mormonism, especially like in third world countries where they're surrounded by just chaos all the time, can be huge, can be enormous. But I don't think that those are because of the metaphysical claims of the church. You know,
it's
these
just,
are
finally they have order. This is what I have to do today. This is what I have to do this Sunday. And they can say, okay, if I do A, B, C, and D, then I'm going to have a good life. And voila, they have a better life than they did before.
It's just like, you know, Job Corps turns some troubled kids around, and it's because of the structure. It's not because of what Job Corps thinks happened on planet Co-op.
You know what? I tell this to people all the time. When I was 10 years old, I knew all the answers to life's hardest questions. And that feels really good. It feels good to think
you didn't understand the questions, but you knew the answers.
Right. I did. And there's something really disturbing about a 10-year-old knowing all of life's answers. But in a lot of ways, it's such a comfort. And I remember... And of course, there's arguments to be made against this, of course. But for me, as a 12-year-old, thinking that there was like going to be a robber outside, the church gave me answers to that. Like I could pray and angels would protect me. Or there's a lot of comfort as a child having these answers.
Yeah, but the church was giving you, for fear. Me anyway, giving me a lot of fear of.
But that's why I say it didn't impact everybody that way. Some kids talk about how lovely the whole thing was. And, you know, for those of us who are more secular, we tend to put everything in like school and academic achievement. So if you think about that, if that is what is being stressed, you know, in a high school where the people who are very flexible and are cheerleaders are at social status, and there is social status to the academics, but they're over in their own corner. Let's say you're not as bright. What the church does is it gives another avenue. You have another path to adulthood. You can go on a mission. You can serve in the priesthood. There is this alternate avenue to success. And I think that is huge and something that the rest of us can take note of.
And that's why it appeals to poor cultures too, because when it tells you what success is, it tells you what happiness is. And there are things that you can do in a poor country. You can still love your family and maybe serve in the ward. That gives you some kind of status, whereas you couldn't in an economical environment. So poor people or mediocre people have a chance to do something.
Right.
And that's really appealing too.
That's a real positive. But unfortunately, it's mostly male.
Yeah, on that note, I would just say that then the onus is on us who are secularists to not just remove the negative of the church, but to replace it with something positive.
Absolutely.
We need to find some sort of way of providing that for our children, that was positive about the church, but that we, for the other reasons that we can't accept what comes along, the baggage that comes along with that.
Right. And there are a lot of
contemplating, sorry.
There are a lot of secular things, groups, activities, that and your family itself that can support children in the same
but
sort of
we're not
ways.
Nearly as good. I'm talking we as in the secular community, as the faith-based community.
Have the infrastructure.
Yeah, but it comes with negatives. Once you put that infrastructure into place, it's going to have some problems. Like,
because then it becomes the institution that we were talking about earlier.
And you can't. Yeah. It's like every positive you're saying, I could see a negative to it. And that's not because I'm trying to find a negative, but okay, for example, I grew up feeling really special in the church, and that was so great for me. But the backhanded slight to it was the fact that I also thought I was better than the non-Mormon people.
Right. You became judgmental because in order for you to be special, other people had to be not so special.
Exactly.
And also sort of the us and them mentality thinking.
And if you're part of a community, that's great. But that also means there are people that are not part of the community. I mean, there's a backside to all of these.
And also there is a huge pressure on perfection. The idea that you should be as perfect as possible and you're always seeking for perfection. And that can cause
a lot of guilt
and psychological trauma.
And then I think there's a strong cultural need to cling onto the trappings of success. And this goes full circle
with
children, making sure that all their hair is, you know, the church culturally, at least in Utah, in this place, is not very forgiving of a 9-year-old girl at church whose hair is not combed.
No.
Again, what is success? What does the church tell us that a successful child looks like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think we really care if a child is competent or makes good choices, as long as they're sitting still and folding their arms and their hair is combed and their shirt is clean.
So the emphasis becomes placed on these outward manifestations of goodness as opposed to actual goodness or things like that.
Well, when you put standards on things that are inherent and hard to judge, what else have you got?
Right.
But
right.
outward appearances.
Yes, so the pressure to be a certain kind of person. Also, scripted relationships with parents and other adults. You never really interact with adults at church in just a natural way. Everything's scripted in the lesson manual. The teacher's not supposed to stray from the lesson manual. And then your parents, they have this certain role that they're supposed to perform in regard to you, and especially your father, who's supposed to do things like the father interviews and stuff like that. That just sort of like weirds up the relationship with parent between parents and children.
Can I say one positive thing that I noticed though? Because I was Googling every conference talk I could find on kids. And one common theme I did see a lot was be kind to your children, be kind to your children, be kind to your children. And, you know, I think it's a good reminder to be kind to your children, not to say that people that aren't in the church are not kind to their children. But that is one positive thing that I saw constantly. I never heard anyone say, not that anyone would say, don't be kind to your children.
Right.
But it's a good reminder to have.
Well, that because children are valued, that then right. That then they're treated with more respect than right. you know, automatically.
Well, not necessarily respect, but they are valued for what they can be, their potential.
Yeah, I agree. Sorry, respect probably wasn't the
right
word.
Well, and if you give, you know, the children the status of being innocent, there is a certain responsibility you have as an authority figure over them to be kind to them. Unfortunately, I think that I could be completely wrong, but I think that the damage is done mostly when children are teenagers in the church. I think primary, I mean, what's the institutional purpose of primary? I think it's to teach you to prepare you how to be in the church, basically.
I think it's to babysit.
Well, it does start pounding in some of those things but I think it's a preparatory, you know, that obey.
Follow the prophet.
Yeah, yeah.
Preschool to the big kids stuff. But when we start getting the harmful doctrine is when they're teenagers and they're still children.
But they're prepped. They're primed for that doctrine. When they get to be teenagers, it's going to hurt.
I agree.
More.
It's a 1-2 punch, but I agree. It's not as bad, you know. And I what I observe from knowing lots and lots of ex-Mormons is people who pulled their kids out of primary to leave the church. Generally, it's met with a cheer. Like the kids don't have any problem. There seems to be an age about 14
where
above that
harder.
It starts becoming hard. But anytime before that, like the kids really don't buy it.
But then again, we're talking about agency. Teenagers are able more than young children to have a voice. I've known more 15-year-olds that say, I don't want to go to church and stop going than I do 8-year-olds that
do that. But you can see right. the resource and treasure and time that the church understands this. There's a reason why we want them in church for 3 hours on Sunday, family home evening on Monday, mutual on between Tuesday and Thursday, often as a weekend activity.
We encourage it. We say, if you don't do this,
right.
your kids are going to fall away.
Yeah. The seminary where we want them 1 hour in school. I mean, mm-hmm. if you think about how much church we put an average high schooler through, it's an amazing amount. And it's not by mistake.
All right. So I think we have at least touched on all of the aspects that I was looking to touch on tonight. And there are other things that we can talk about another time. And I think overall, our consensus is it's probably not the best place to raise children, but it's not like, you know, all of us were raised in Mormonism and we're free thinkers.
Right.
We can self-evaluate and we're thriving.
I would say like evaluate the costs and benefits. Like if you think that here's the costs, we covered a lot of costs, and you evaluate the benefits and the benefits mean more to you than the costs, then I would raise your kids in the church.
And you know, my message to everybody out there is, and I said this earlier in the podcast, the church tends to take things from you and then sell them back to you. And for all the parents out there, you're a much better parent. You're a much better ethicist. You're a much better moralist than the church would have you believe. And the transition comes then you find that you're a much better parent than even the church would have you believe. That it's very scary to take that leap.
And sometimes it's about letting go a little bit. Like not hovering so much and not trying to make your children a certain
be
way.
Be what you want them to be.
Yeah.
And let them be who they need to be.
Right.
Right. Right. Because you'll find oftentimes there's a lot of things you fuss about because they didn't get
and
their shoes on Sunday. That just stopped mattering. You know?
At the end of the day, kids, no matter how they're raised, make mistakes.
They
that
do.
Is just a fact of life.
They really have strong personalities, and I think...
And it's not because, well, not necessarily because they were adults in the pre-existence.
I think this is an American thing more so than just a church thing, but we obsess about being perfect parents.
Yeah.
And I really think people need to cut themselves a little bit more slack and realize that they're much better parents than the church would have you believe. That if you choose to leave the church, you'll do much better as a parent. Than you think you will.
Amen, brother. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for participating tonight. We'll look forward to future discussions.
Wait, we still have our t-shirt logo contest.
Oh, yeah, announcements.
That should be due on May 1st. We're giving out $100 for that. The essay contest, this is our third annual essay contest. Is due. We have the one of the winners right here.
Yes.
Is it worth your time and effort?
Oh, I had a blast doing it, actually.
Did I not hand you $100 in greenbacks?
Yeah, and I got lots of, I made lots of buddies at the picnic where you gave it.
Did you go shopping at the mall with your money?
I still get people who are like, that essay was yours? That's so awesome.
Right, so,
you know, you get a lot of street
fame,
cred.
Yeah. Fortune, street cred, and money. Those are due June 1st. What else is going on? If you go over to the Mormon Expression page, go to the community menu and you can see events. We have events now listed all over the country and more are being listed every day.
Right. And you can participate by planning an activity or event.
And then the big ones, we have November 10th, the informal weekend in Las Vegas. There'll be more details to come. And then, early spring, January, February next year will be our Mexican,
resort.
So start saving your pennies. As soon as we have that booked, we'll let y'all know.
All right. Thank you, John.
All right.
For the announcements. Oh, and this is brought.
Well, and Lindsay's here. Lindsay, let's hear about the art show.
Oh, yeah. The art
show. Yeah. We're doing it's actually couched under Mormon stories. But it's for everybody. We would love Mormon Expression listeners too. We're going to have an art show that's going to correspond with the Mormon Stories conference in June. And you can contact me on Facebook about it, and you can. I think you guys have it listed on your site, right?
Yeah, and if
your link to it.
If people don't know, they can send us an email. We'll pass it on to
Lindsay. Yeah, we're taking art of any kind. If you want a quilt, like we love Mormon arts, crochet, photography, painting, cross stitching. Yeah, send it all in. We'd love to see you express your Mormonism through art.
Mormon Expression is a product of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. And this and other podcasts and endeavors such as Mormon Expression Voices are made possible through your generous support.
Thank you.